Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer.
And I'm Roman Segel, recovering marketer. Andrew and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we both had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know but want to know more about, how they got their start, how they make it work, and what keeps them going.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee, or in my case, hot chocolate.
On today's show, we're talking to Dr. Barbara Oakley, an engineering professor, author, and the creator and instructor of Learning to Learn, the most popular massive open online course ever with over 1 million enrolled students. Huh, I didn't realize that MOOCs were part of the P&G training these days.
Hey, Raman, how's it going?
Oh, hey, it's Dorian Positano, who's P&G's Director of New Business and Content Innovation and AI Integration Strategy, who also happens to host P&G's internal podcast, More Than Soap, which is available to all P&G employees worldwide. Dorian, it's great to have you back on Learnings from Leaders. So tell me more about this podcast of yours that we already love.
Sure. So 2 years ago, I started a global employee podcast at P&G. To kind of help bring the outside in and also spotlight the P&G leaders who are helping to take the company into the future. And in each episode, I sit down with an external guest who's an expert in some area. And that could be anyone from a CEO to a psychologist, brain scientist, biologist. And I mean, we've even had award-winning filmmakers like Edward Norton and Matthew McConaughey. And legends like Rick Rubin and Malcolm Gladwell. So it's a pretty wide spectrum of amazing people. And then for P&G employees, we do a post-interview with a P&G leader to help unpack the insights and connect the learnings to what we do at P&G.
Yeah, your guest list is quite impressive. So tell me about the name of the show, though.
So we call the show More Than Soap because, as we all know, P&G is so much more than just a soap company. And the possibilities of what we can do to build the business and impact the world are just endless.
All right. So tell me about today's guest, Dorian.
My guest today is Dr. Barbara Oakley. Barbara is a professor of engineering, and her work focuses on the complex relationship between neuroscience and social behavior. Barbara is a true polymath. She was a captain in the U.S. Army, a Russian translator on Soviet trawlers, a radio operator in the South Pole, an engineer, university professor, researcher, and author of 8 books. And if that isn't enough, she is also the creator and instructor of Learning How to Learn, the most popular massive open online course, or MOOC, ever, with over 1 million enrolled students.
Yeah, this is a really great one, and I'm just so excited to share this episode with our audience, and this will be one of several that we'll continue to feature, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention, for the benefit of all of the P&G employees who we know are listening to this P&G alumni podcast, those of you who have not yet subscribed to More Than Soap yet, you gotta check it out, because you'll have exclusive access to not just the entire catalog of amazing conversations that Dorian and his entire team have each week, but P&G employees will also get access to post-interview conversations with P&G leaders like Shailesh, Fama, Sundar, and many more of the P&G executive team. And as Dorian mentioned, the podcast continues to evolve into its new chapter, sponsored by P&G's Chief R&D Officer, Victor Aguilar. So keep your ears open for a great new spin on a show that we already love listening to.
That's right, Raman. And for all past episodes, P&G employees around the world can just go to getmorethansoap.com to hear all of our exclusive content, which you can listen to on your favorite podcast player.
That's so awesome. I'm super jealous of all of our friends still at P&G who'll continue to get to hear these great conversations. So I know we're looking forward to lots of future podcasting partnerships with More Than Soap on this show. So without further ado, let's jump straight into another curiosity-inspiring More Than Soap conversation.
Yes, Crest really works.
It's me. Don't tweet the Charmin.
More doctors advise ivory for the skin than any other soap.
Barbara Oakley, welcome to the More Than Soap podcast.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Dorian.
Pleasure to have you. So, Barbara, I was doing my research for this podcast, And I saw that you had lived in 10 different places by the time you were in 10th grade. And you've been in the U.S. Army. You learned Russian. You've lived in Russia and Germany. And after your army duties ended, you became an engineer. And you've been a radio operator at the South Pole Station in Antarctica. And I could go on, but suffice it to say, it sounds like you've had a plethora of unique experiences. And it seems to me that you have embraced wholeheartedly continuous steep learning curves in life. And I know from reading your book that learning something new, especially as an adult, can be very hard, you know, and it can actually feel bad sometimes. And I'm sure we'll walk through the neuroscience, which explains why it can feel bad. But tell us a little bit more about your background and what has led you to where you are and what you do professionally today.
So when I was growing up, I moved a lot. My father was in the Air Force. So by the time I was 15, I'd lived in 10 different places. But this taught me something that I think people in general can learn more easily than I did, which is simply the idea that when you first begin anything, it's really uncomfortable. And you can feel like a failure. You can feel out of place, like everybody else is better than you are at whatever you're studying or doing or whatever.
Right.
And that actually having these feelings of being an imposter and being less able than the others that you might be starting to work with or to learn from is a real advantage. Because as I found later when I was a professor of engineering, the students who walked into my class all cocky because they knew they were just the, you know, the bee's knees and they could do whatever, they were far less likely to feel uncomfortable and to use that as a prompt to help them to learn more effectively. So it was the ones who walked in and said, you know, I'm older than the other students here. I'm not as good. I'm really not sure I can do this. Those were the ones who got A's in the course. I mean, almost inevitably. So being comfortable with the idea of being uncomfortable, that starting anything new, learning anything new can feel like, oh, I can't do this. It's so uncomfortable.
Right.
Everybody goes, well, maybe not everybody, but the good people often go through these experiences and just keep working through them and you'll see they'll help you to excel.
Well, speaking of learning, you wrote a book recently called Learn Like a Pro. And I wanted to ask you, what would you say are the most commonly unknown learning hacks, I'll call them, that people should know about?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. One of the most common challenges in learning is that when you hear somebody say something or you read a book, you think that you're learning it, but you're actually just kind of passing your eyes superficially over or superficially listening to the material, but it doesn't necessarily go into neural links in long-term memory. And it's these connections in long-term memory that are actually when you learn something.
Right.
So your best bet for real learning is not to just sit there and listen and or watch and read. I mean, that's good to start with, but to instead try to retrieve the main ideas of what you've just seen, heard, experienced, or been taught. And it is this retrieval practice that is what strengthens the new ideas of learning in the architecture of your own memory. If you just, you know, kind of like draw a concept map, you know, which is like connecting main ideas, or you reread or underline things, you're not actually strengthening those neural links in long-term memory, which are at the heart of learning. When people tell you, you don't need to remember this stuff because you can always look it up, you know immediately that they know little to nothing about real learning and how it takes place in the brain. For years, people have said, oh, drill is kill. That's a terrible thing. You should never have students memorize the multiplication tables or memorize equations or anything like that. au contraire. It turns out that this practice, drill leads to skill. For example, even simply learning the multiplication tables, what it does is it helps create patterns so that you understand how numbers are related to one another. And that is critically important. Let's say you're a coder and you know that there's, you know, certain hacks, alt keys and so forth, you know, that you can use to help you more speedily program. And people will say, well, you know, you can learn those things, but you can always look them up. Don't believe them. Fast programmers are fast because they have memorized those. They've internalized those hacks.
Right.
So you want to do that too. Actually make flashcards of the things you want to be able to pull together instantly to mind. So those include, you know, the kind of the alt key sort of things that help speed your programming. Also, let's say that you're learning algorithms. Well, memorize the algorithm so that you can pull it quickly to mind. And you might say, well, yeah, but I can always just use it. But you will internalize the main ideas of that algorithm better. I mean, poets will often say, well, memorize the poem and you will understand it more deeply. But why should we let the poets have all the fun?
But there is a distinction between memorization and deep understanding, right? I certainly remember that from back in my elementary and high school days. I could cram for a test and memorize the content, do decently well on the test, but not deeply understand the concepts such that I could really go to the next level and perform in a more advanced course. So can you help me with that distinction? Because I'm hearing you say that memorization is important, but it's, I don't think, a substitute for deep understanding, right?
That's a very perceptive question, and it helps me to kind of bring out a key idea here. Sure, if you are simply looking at how to solve an equation and you memorize the solution without understanding what you've memorized, it's like memorizing the sound Здравствуйте, как вы поживаете, without knowing what it actually means. I mean, it's just a series of sounds. So sure, you can memorize it, but it's kind of relatively useless unless you're exactly in that situation where you want someone.
What did you just say? Do I need to cut it out?
No, I said, hello, how are you?
Oh, okay, so that's relatively that passes benign. The test.
Although having worked on Russian fishing trawlers, I can say lots of things that are not benign.
I bet.
In fact, I would repeat them occasionally to the sailors and they'd say, oh, don't say that again. You know, I'd say, what really? Does this mean? And they'd say, no, I'm not going to explain that. But here's the important point. When I say memorize, say, an algorithm or an equation or a sentence in a foreign language, what I'm really saying is pull it from your own mind. So when you are looking at an equation that you want to know how to solve, look at it, see if you can write down the first step in the solution from your own mind. Then see if your intuition whispers to you what the second step is and the third step so that you can solve it without looking. If you have to peek to begin with, you know, do that. But ultimately, you want to solve that equation enough times that you can, you know, at first you can write it all out and you can pull it from your mind by doing that. But then you can actually pull it from your own mind simply by looking at that problem. You go, oh yeah, I do step A, step B, step C, step. And what that is, it's basically equivalent to, would you sing a song one time and think you knew that song? Of course not. You want to be able to sing that song enough times that it flows, you know, like a regular song from your own mind.
Right.
You also want to do the same with key equations and with key algorithms and key sentences in a foreign language and whatever you're using. And what that is doing is that's actually placing these things you're learning, not only in the hippocampal declarative parts of your memory, but also in the procedural basal ganglia-related parts of your memory. And that makes it super fast and super intuitive.
It reminds me of another question I had for you related to experience and the role of having firsthand experience in order to actually learn something deeply. I talked to a management consultant a few weeks ago who came onto the podcast and has become actually now a life coach or career coach, and focuses specifically on developing managers. And she teaches at the Wharton School of Business. And the insight was that I think we underestimate the importance of actually having experience being a manager of others versus learning what it means on paper to be a good manager. Is there something different that's going on in the brain when you actually experience something firsthand versus reading it? And is that something that you think in today's day and age, where there's just so much easy access to information, that we underestimate the importance of doing?
Well, doctors certainly don't underestimate the importance of doing. This is why you can get all this book learning through, in the U.S., 4 years of medical school, but then you have to do 2, 3, 4 years or more of practice with internship and residency.
Right.
It's because you just can't teach a lot of aspects of doctoring through a book. This goes to something that I've been alluding to. The brain has two major superhighways you can use to deposit those sets of links into long-term memory, you know, to make those connections. The first way is declarative learning through the hippocampus. And this happens when you have something explained to you.
Right.
So, for example, when we're teaching on this podcast or talking about things on this podcast, people are getting the ideas through their declarative hippocampal system. But the second way is through that basal ganglia procedural system. This is the system that learns through practice and experience. And it's very different. It's a system that can learn all sorts of complicated things. So some teachers will denigrate it as, oh, it's just rote learning. It's just memorization. Far from it. In fact, this is the system that learns really complicated patterns. And it also helps with learning managerial skills. So you can read about it all you want, but unless you also develop these skills through that procedural system by practicing, it's all theoretical and you're just not going to have experience applying it. I mean, you can see this in all sorts of areas. In language learning, you can learn all sorts of stuff out of the book. You can even recite pages of vocabulary lists, but you can't speak the language unless you practice the language.
Right.
In math, you can learn all the theory or, you know, like engineering and coding. You can learn all the things you're supposed to do, but unless you're practicing with thousands and thousands of practice problems and experiences, you don't develop those conjoined other sets of links. You have both declarative and procedural links.
Right.
And both are what really help with great learning. And so for managers, you can learn a lot, and you can't discount what you do learn declaratively, you know, through explanations.
Right.
That can help lay the seed for good procedural learning, but you got to get that practice and procedural learning in there. Otherwise, it's just not going to be intuitive and something that you can really use effectively.
Right. Well, I'll give you another example. I'm a golfer, and I've been golfing since I was pretty young. And I'll ask this question and then we'll figure out how to tie it back to what we do at P&G. So my swing, my golf swing, looks pretty decent, okay? But there are some really bad habits that are ingrained into my brain and have been ingrained, I think, procedurally based on what you just described, that caused me to quite frequently hit the most horrendous shot, okay, you've ever seen in your life. And I often think to myself, it would probably be better if I could just wipe out everything I know about golf and start over, since those habits are so ingrained after years and years of being a golfer. So imagine you want to learn something new, and this new way of operating or approaching something is in complete conflict with something that you have learned previously. Is there a way to unlearn something that's been learned procedurally, you know, that's ingrained, to make way for the new, more desired behavior?
It is so hard to do that.
So give up golf is what you're saying.
No, because even Tiger Woods, he would figure out a new approach he wanted to use for his swing. He just knew that he would go backwards and that it would be many months of practice before he would regain his previous ability to hit, because he was going to use this new technique.
Right. So is it always an overwrite? Like I heard, for example, when you delete something on your computer, it kind of just stays there until you overwrite the data with something new. Is that the way to think about it?
It's still going to be there. It's kind of like you're building on Roman ruins. It's still sort of there, and all of that stuff can still affect how you even position the new building, but you can create new sets of links. Then if you practice a lot with them, your habitual procedural system will turn to this thing that you've been practicing a lot with. Are the old links there? Yeah. But, you know, the less you use them and the more you're practicing with these new links, the better and stronger they will get. So it is possible. And in fact, physics professors will rue the fact that it's so hard to teach people fundamental ideas related to inertia and so forth, because our real life experience is very different than the true theoretical what's really going on in the universe. Like when we throw a ball, we experience that, you know, it stops after a while, and we think it's some innate characteristic of the ball, but it's not. It's actually the friction that makes it stop. But trying to teach students, you know, it's a lifetime of experience knowing that your ball has this thing in it that makes it stop after you throw it. It is possible to do. It just takes much more practice to rewrite or to create new sets of links with the procedural kind of learning than it does with declarative, which are automatically quite flexible. So like if I learn how to type, I learn to type procedurally. It takes a lot of practice to do that, but I'm really fast. But my husband, for example, is a very mischievous man. So let's say he went and he reprogrammed my keyboard so that it, you know, it had different keys. It would just take me a really long time to readjust because I've learned procedurally.
Right.
But I could still do it.
And it sounds to me like you need to be aware of what change is taking place or what you want to take place. Meaning you need to be aware of the old bad habit or undesired habit. And you need to be aware of what you want to do differently. Like Tiger Woods, when he looked at his swing, he said, I need to change this part of my swing, and that's what I'll focus on rewiring procedurally. I was wondering about that when I was listening to one of your talks. Given that motivation to learn something new is driven by the extent to which you desire to learn something new, can that desire be intentionally manufactured, or does it simply just emerge? But what I'm hearing you say is it can't be. And I'm curious if that's what you did when you took up mathematics to become an engineer. Your brain must have looked at your history and said, well, this isn't me, and I don't like this. I'm not good at it. I don't want to do it. But obviously, you found a way to transform that point of view.
Right.
So I was hoping you could talk to us a little bit about that and maybe explain for the listeners who aren't familiar with that story what happened.
The long and the short of it was I hated math and science growing up, and I was terrible at them. Since we moved a lot of the time, I was always ahead in reading. I loved reading, but anything to do with math or science, I was always behind at. I didn't like it. I didn't want to do it. So I just flunked my way through elementary, middle, and high school math and science. And then I enlisted in the Army right out of high school to learn a language. I randomly picked Russian. And in the military, they made me, I went through the Defense Language Institute and so forth, and then they made me a signal officer. Of course, I didn't know anything about math or science, and I felt like an absolute, and I was an idiot about all this stuff. And I was like one of the world's worst signal officers. They sent me through signal officer training school. I graduated bottom in my class. And I worked with all these West Point engineers in West Germany and really struggled with, even now I look back and it's like simplest concepts. Well, you got a circuit, you know, it goes here and then it comes back and that's it. But I could see that the West Point engineers I was working with had all these great job opportunities. And I realized that like no recruiters were knocking on my door saying, I've just got to have your Slavic languages and literature skills.
Yeah.
And truly, there was not anything more alien to my personality than studying engineering. But at the same time, I loved adventures. You know, I went to the South Pole Station, worked as a radio operator there, worked out on Soviet trawlers. You know, kind of traveled and worked all around the world. And I just thought, well, you know, if you love new adventures and new perspectives, there couldn't be anything better than just like learning engineering, because it's like so alien. So why don't you see if you could do it? Number one, it was a challenge because it was so alien. And then I kind of felt like, gosh, if I can do this, you know, a lot more people can do this kind of thing than think they can do it. But also it was a motivation because, you know, I didn't want to end up in a job like I had in the military where you have to work for someone. And if they're completely incompetent or good, you're stuck. You've got to work for that person. And, you know, no matter what, you've got to do what you're told. And I just wanted a lot more options in my life. And I could see that if I, you know, what I had done before was I'd done what everybody told me to do, which is follow your passion, do what you love. And what I didn't realize was that's actually like people telling you, be completely selfish about your career and don't worry about what the world needs. But what I should have been doing was, you know, not only following my own passion, but broadening my passion. And so that's when I went back. I was 26 years old and I started with remedial high school algebra and slowly began working my way upwards. And so it was a dual motivation. It was a motivation externally because I wanted to be able to get a position that was doing things that I found to be interesting, even if I didn't particularly like the study path I would have to follow in order to get there.
Right.
And the other was just the personal challenge of, you know, can you do something that is totally alien to your personality? So I'm really glad I did this. And part of the reason I'm so glad is because I think it just serves as a good example for the many people among us who are in a similar situation, who are wondering whether they can, you know, really change themselves to learn accounting or to learn coding or to change to a new related career path or unrelated career path at PNG and move forward into an interesting area, whether or not they initially think they've got the capability to do it.
Right. Well, I understand very clearly step one, which is excite yourself about the concept and what you might be able to achieve by taking on something new. And you talked about what worked for you was, you know, I love adventures and yes, this isn't who I think I am, but it's a new steep learning curve that will help broaden my passions. I love the way you described that. But step two is where things can fall apart because, for example, I just took up learning the piano and I love the idea of being able to play the piano and I love music. And so the thought of being able to just play one of my favorite songs is really amazing to me. But I'm in this stage now where learning music theory is challenging and very different from how I think my brain is wired or, you know, has been wired to date. And I'm having to work through the discomfort and frustration of that practice, you know, and that consistency of finding 20 or 30 minutes a day to do it. And so what's your advice for people who have set a goal and started doing something that they're curious about, but are working through the inevitable discomfort and frustrations of what it means to actually learn something new and broaden your passions in that way? Because it isn't that you go from day one of not knowing how to do something and not having a particular interest or personality, however you want to describe it, to day, you know, 14 of I'm now consistently super passionate and highly interested consistently in this new challenging thing.
Jerry Seinfeld has advice to new comedians. I think his advice is relevant to all of us who are trying to learn something new. It's basically get a calendar and every day you write a joke and you mark it off on the calendar. And this idea of just sort of each day you got to do whatever you set out. So let's say it's a half an hour of piano every day. When you see that calendar on your wall and you see the X's growing and you go, oh, there's something about that day-to-day, you know, there's been research too that shows that if you have like a day-to-day and you're developing a sequential chain of events, the longer it gets, the more you're kind of like, oh, you know, this is like Alcoholics Anonymous or something. I've been dry for, you know, however many, like the longer it goes, the more it becomes a habit and you'll be able to progress even though it's a rough, long slog. To learn to play the piano well is not like, oh, every day is going to be really fun. In fact, a lot of days are not going to be fun. Don't get me started. I do get a little irritated at modern day educators in K-12 who are like, I mean, everybody knows that you got to practice if you want to learn the piano.
Yeah.
Or you want to learn a foreign language. Or if you want to learn pretty much anything.
Yeah.
Except for K-12 math educators who are like, oh, practice is so bad. It's terrible.
Really?
I did an op-ed in the New York Times a few years ago. And just talking about the importance of practice in learning math. And you would have thought I had suggested burning down all elementary schools through the country.
Oh,
I mean, it was like, that will kill students' motivation for learning math. Well, you know, it's like saying, well, we want everybody to learn guitar by playing air guitar all the time. You've got to practice.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing that makes it even worse that I read, I think in your book or heard you say at some point, is that you should be practicing basically all the things you don't want to be practicing. I found that with piano, I consistently go back to practicing one of my favorite songs. And I've become really good at that song, but I'm not becoming better at the piano. Step one, obviously, is you need to practice. But step two is you have to force yourself to practice what makes you frustrated and uncomfortable and actually gives you, in the moment, kind of a bad feeling.
Oh, yep. So there's a fantastic psychologist, Bob Bjork at UCLA, and he has this concept of deliberate practice, which is basically focusing on the hard stuff.
Yeah.
Like some people will say, oh, it's so important to get in the flow. No, it's not important to get in the flow. Not if you want to really be pushing yourself to learn something new.
Right.
Flow develops about stuff you already know and can do. And then you can kind of sail along knowing, you know, going with this stuff you already know. But deliberate practice takes you beyond that edge into, you know, something that's pushing yourself with the really, like recall practice, retrieval practice, which we talked about. It's like super not easy. It's so much easier to just look at a page instead of seeing if you can retrieve something from your own mind.
Right.
But it's invaluable, you know, that little push. The trick is to not sit there and go, okay, today it's a Saturday and I'm going to sit and study and push myself with retrieval practice for 10 hours today. Well, no, it's just not going to work, and you're going to end up hating whatever you're learning. You want to space out your practice. So let's say you're studying something, maybe in an hour a day on that topic, you know, 2 hours or something. It depends on how much time you've got. Maybe putting a half an hour of that on like super the hardest stuff you can get. Usually people have about 2 hours a day that is like they can really do hard stuff. And then you can go 4 hours a day, you know, if you mix in, you've got like four really super productive hours, two of which are like the hardest stuff. But we work 8 hours a day. So what does that mean? It doesn't mean, oh, you only work 4 hours because that's when you're pretty good. It means you do the easier stuff in a, usually it's the later part of the day. So if it's answering emails or something like that, that are relatively straightforward and intellectually less demanding, hopefully, you know, try to put the less intellectually demanding stuff into part of the day that's not where you're really doing that critical, deliberate practice.
Right. Well, one other thing I've been trying to do more of is sleep. And so I wanted to talk to you about what actually happens when you sleep that enables the learning process. And does getting more sleep help you transform that 2 hours that you just talked about into 4 hours or, you know, 5 hours of productivity during the day?
Sleep is an interesting question. There is absolutely no doubt that the bulk of our learning takes place during sleep.
During sleep.
So you gotta, of course, you gotta front load the stuff you're trying to learn. So you're studying during the day. But what happens is you've got these connections between neurons that you're making when you're learning anything. So you're making these connections when you're learning something, and you have sort of weak connections during the day, but at night, your brain kind of searches through and says, which connections were the really important ones to this person? How it figures that out, we don't know, although we do know it helps if right before you go to sleep, you try to bring back to mind the key ideas that you were trying to learn or master. So take 5 minutes, get that in mind, and then that sort of can signal the brain somehow, practice with those ideas. So when you're sleeping, we can actually see electrical signals going down the axons and passing from neuron to neuron hundreds of times over an evening. Now, some people have memories that help them learn faster. You know, they have a really good memory. And so you might think, oh, you know, I wish I had a memory like that. I mean, I'd love to have a memory that was really good. But it turns out that that can actually lead to disadvantages. And the reason is this. So you have to like these little toes that stick out or like little sticks that stick out of, they're called dendritic spines, that are the point where the connections are made between neurons. So you have an axon that leads down to a bouton, and then it skips a little gap called a synapse, and it goes on to the dendritic spine of the next neuron. You don't need to remember all that nomenclature, but what is interesting here is that some people at night have a differing bath of neurochemicals that does not sweep away so many of these dendritic spines. And of course, if you've got those spines still left there, that means you can remember more easily. So some people can remember with ease. They can look at a page and actually remember all the words on the page of a book.
And that's because at night, I've heard you call the janitor that comes by and sweeps the dendritic spines
away
is leaving a lot more of those.
Yes.
Okay.
For people who have a good memory. So you might say, oh, well, see, that's the super smart person who can learn more quickly. We want them running our company and so forth. No, not necessarily. Because those spines aren't swept away, they're locked in place. And keep in mind that golf swing problem that you had. If you're spines are locked into place, that means that once you make a decision about something or you come to a conclusion or you've learned something, you can't rewrite it very easily. You're very inflexible in your thinking. So it turns out there's plenty of evidence that fast thinkers, like really smart, fast learners, are often inflexible and they're inaccurate. So they're like really fast, they jump to conclusions, but when they're wrong, they can't change their mind. Whereas slower learners can be much more flexible and much more accurate in their learning. So this is kind of like, you know, the person in the back of the boardroom, and they're just really quiet because shy people, they can often be slower learners. So you get the shy person in the back of the boardroom. And then at the end, they go, hey, wait a minute, you guys are not considering this. And it's a really perceptive comment. And of course, it's something that that slower learner was able to kind of put together that all the ones that were jumping to conclusions could not see.
Right.
So this is why companies and teams need to have a mixture of super fast, but also slower, but more accurate learners on their teams.
Absolutely. So I want to completely change gears here, since you've written about a number of other topics beyond learning and how the brain works. And to segue into that conversation, I want to ask you about one's ability to change someone else's beliefs. I think you've written about this topic, so I wanted to ask if you could first explain your rationale for why it's often not possible for individuals to change other individuals' beliefs. And then I want to talk to you about whether or not you think large organizations like P&G have the power to change beliefs at a macro level in society.
So this goes back, in part at least, to what we were speaking about earlier with the procedural system. So it's not just learning golf swings and native language and how to do math problems or how to solve a Rubik's Cube. Yes, it's doing all that. But it's also developing what's called a value function. And the value function is sort of its expectations of the world and what is good and what is not good. What your value function comes to feel is something you are completely, for the most part, unaware of. You know, you can apply this to politics, religion, or, you know, pick your controversial topic. But let's just apply this to something I love, which is dogs.
Okay.
You know, let's say that early in your life, you might be exposed to some dogs that were pretty savage.
Yeah.
What this creates within you is a value function about dogs such that when you see a dog, you know, your value function is going to go, that thing's dangerous. And I don't care whether it's a Chihuahua or a Great Dane.
Right.
For me, I'm going to be like, oh, you know, it's a dog. Let's see if it's wagging its tail.
Yeah.
This value function subconsciously influences your conscious objective thinking from your declarative system.
Right.
Let's say you're talking about, you know, pick whatever controversial or even non-controversial, you know, to me, dogs are not controversial. You know, you can explain something step by logical step using your hippocampal declarative system. And that's what you think the other person is responding to you with, but they're not. They may be listening to you through their hippocampal declarative system, but they are being influenced subconsciously by that biased output of the procedural system, that output function. So what this means, you think you're just stepping through something that's logical, but what you're arguing against is thousands and thousands of previous experiences and thoughts and training and experiences that that person has previously had.
Right.
So that when you are doing your step-by-step, there's this incredibly complex web of deep learning. And not to say that isn't in the hippocampus, but you're more aware of the hippocampus. This deep learning web that is taking place through your procedural system, I don't care what you give as a, you know, step-by-step perfect example of what you're trying to talk someone else into, or at least understanding, they will have some way of navigating around and saying that's a stupid example. And here's why. It doesn't apply because of. So you can have, for example, two highly trained statisticians. One is pro whatever controversial you know, want to pick, the others against it. You present them with a paper. If it's for the thing that the one statistician supports, that statistician's going to love the paper.
Yeah.
If they're against it, they're going to hate the paper, even if they're equally highly trained statisticians, because each one has a different value function that is subconsciously influencing their thinking.
Right.
So this is why when you might be arguing politics, for example, or, you know, whatever, or let's say it's on the job and you're arguing about what's the best way to proceed, and you know, the theory says, and you could show logically this theory, and then someone else who's had lots of experience in this is going to say, well, you know, you're dead wrong, because their procedural system has had all this influence that makes it, or experience that will give them a completely different perspective, no matter what may be logically laid out. Sometimes this is good, sometimes it's bad, because, you know, sometimes you simply can't use logic to convince some people, no matter how logical you may think you're being. But then sometimes experiences really, really matter too.
Right.
So it's a little bit of a gamble either way.
So if you're aware of this, if you're aware that the brain operates in this way and that your subconscious value system is impacting your perception and your beliefs and how you interpret, whether it be controversial issues or non-controversial issues, do you believe that you can consistently override your own value system and recognize that something has been conditioned into you that way and operate differently? Or do you think that for the most part, we're a slave to that conditioning?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think it depends on the person. And again, this has to do with the flexibility of those dendritic spines. You know, some people, and they're really smart people, there's just no way that they can change.
Yeah.
But I also know some really super smart people, you know, they are flexible. They can be convinced. It's almost like if you have a really, really smart person, it's almost like 50-50. Are they going to be one of those really inflexible, dogmatic people? Or are they going to be one of these gems who just brings their brilliance to enhance whatever is? So even in scientific research, they did a massive review study of hundreds of thousands, actually millions of research papers and so forth. And what they found was that fields often will advance once the major figure dies, because the major figure kind of locked everybody into their way of doing things. And it was only with their death that, you know, the field was able to flourish. But on the other hand, some leading figures in science go out of their way to help nurture young scientists and to create whole new fields. So it's sort of a 50-50 thing. Is it a nurturer? Is it a, you know, more of a squash it if it's not my idea person? And it's always hard to tell from afar, because, you know, the one who's more of a squasher and a bully in private life, they can portray themselves as superheroes, whereas the ones who are really, you know, more nurturers, they don't tend to blow their horn. So, you know, looking at afar, unless you know them personally, it's really hard to tell. And this is true in business as well.
Yeah.
You know, are they nurturers? Are they bullies? Are they a mixture? Sometimes you got to be a bit of a bully to get, you know, your ideas forth. You know, it's fascinating just sort of figuring out what happens with people.
Well, speaking about value systems and the subconscious conditioning that impacts how human beings view the world and what's good and what's bad, you've written about something called pathological altruism. And at the risk of being canceled myself, I'd like to go down this path for a little bit because I think it's important. I think it's particularly important today, given polarization and distrust of organizations and government. So maybe we could start by having you explain what that concept is or what it means to you, and then we can have a discussion about it.
Well, I was a little surprised. So I did an edited academic volume for Oxford University Press called Pathological Altruism, and I pulled together key figures in a variety of fields to talk about what does it mean when intentions to do good actually lead to harm.
Right.
Which is what is at a deepest level is what pathological altruism is. The book was so well received that it even had a wonderful review in the New York Times, which is like virtually unheard of for academic edited volumes. I also did a paper for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and presented for the National Academy of Sciences on pathologies of altruism. And that's how I met my mentor, who's one of those nurturers that I mentioned before. That's Terry Sanowski. He's the Francis Crick Professor at the Salk Institute, and he's one of only 12 living human beings who's simultaneously a member of the National Academy of Sciences, Medicine, and Engineering.
Wow.
We have so many wonderful, wonderful human beings in society. And one of the things that we're often taught and that these wonderful human beings have been taught is that empathy is one of the most important things that we can teach others and teach children. But what they don't really understand is that empathy is a double-edged sword. You know, how do you get codependent behavior where a woman or a man, for that matter, can take incredible abuse from their spouse for years? Well, part of it is they think they're doing good to just say yes to whatever and to, hold the family together and be agreeable and all this kind of thing. Like when we're teaching about social and emotional learning, that's a really important area. It's important in colleges, at businesses, and so forth. But one thing that they don't teach as part of social emotional learning is that it's important to learn to say no. It's important that when someone takes advantage of you, that you learn to set boundaries and limits.
Yeah.
Let's go back to something that I think underpins this whole area. And that is the research of Joan McCord, who was the first female president of the American Criminology Society. But she was a fantastic sociologist who had her PhD from Stanford. And her specialty was, long-term follow-up on social programs that were meant to benefit other people. So she did, for example, 30 years after a five-year experiment was conducted on a group of 500 Boston schoolboys. And they took 250 of these boys and did nothing. 250 of the other group, they gave them pretty much every advantage you could possibly imagine they could get. They got extra tutoring for the kids in the family. They had extra babysitting, medical care. They got to go to summer camps, all sorts of great things. So Joan McCord followed up 30 years later after that initial five-year intervention. She was able to find almost all, 98% of everyone.
Wow.
And she found that one group had significantly higher levels of suicide, of drug abuse, alcohol abuse. They ended up in lower capacity jobs. It was, in every respect, the one group stood out from the other negatively. And which group was that? It was, of course,
the one that had all the advantages.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we can think we're doing things because superficially and obviously it seems helpful for others, but we can actually be doing them harm.
Right.
And this happens so often in societies that, for example, even the people who were doing that study originally, they couldn't even imagine that their study was actually doing harm for the boys.
Right.
So they didn't even look for that.
Yeah.
And many social programs, for example, there's a program called Critical Incident Stress Debriefing. Like if you have a really traumatic experience, you meet with a counselor who specializes in this and you retell the experience in as vivid a detail as you possibly can in order to kind of get it out of you. So after 9/11, some 9,000 specialists in critical incident stress debriefing descended on New York City to help those who had experienced high stress during, the Twin Towers. But there was a problem in that nobody had actually studied critical incident stress debriefing to see if it actually did what it was supposed to be doing. And when they did study it, they found out that either it didn't help people or, of course, it made the situation worse. And naturally, it would make it worse. Think about it. You're asking someone to do retrieval practice on something that's really traumatic. What are you doing? You're not like getting it out of them. You're burning it more deeply inside them.
Right.
This technique is still used, and nobody ever had questioned it and studied it. And when they did, they found out it was a perfect example of pathological altruism.
Right.
So many programs, and it's hard for people to understand, because if everybody in psychology is using this program and promoting it, surely it couldn't have not been studied, and surely it would be effective. So it's very hard for people to realize how often seemingly benign and helpful approaches are being recommended, even at businesses, that actually can make a situation worse. And if you say something, you know, going back to political correctness, if you say something, you can often be like, oh, you evil person, you're not for helping whoever it is. And if you say, well, I'm just not sure that it's actually helping, it could be making things worse.
Right.
Then suddenly that procedural system of theirs, which has been trained that anyone who says something negative, they've got to be an evil person.
Hmm.
And then suddenly you have cancellations occurring.
Right.
When actually it's a person whom you probably very well should have been listening to.
Right. So my question for you is, how do you distinguish between an investment financially or an investment of time that an individual or organization should make in the area of citizenship or being a force for good in the world versus one that may end up having massive negative consequences that are unintended?
Well, that's a little question, she said facetiously.
Right.
But that's a deep and important question. And I think it goes back to our discussion of declarative and procedural learning. So often what we experience is what we feel very deeply and intuitively is correct.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking objectively through that declarative system is really, really hard. So it often feels easier to just do what feels right.
Right.
Instead of thinking about it declaratively, objectively, and critically. A related story is the old lady who swallowed the fly.
Mm.
You know, to get the fly, she got a mouse and then a horse and then a, you know, and it kept going that she was swallowing all these things to eliminate the previous problem. And of course, that just made the problem worse.
Right.
What people who are doing, like, let's say that a company hires someone to do training to alleviate some social ill. What the trainers are going to do is, it's kind of like swallowing the fly. All they're going to do is look at what they're doing and say, hey, look, see, it's better. But they're not looking at the side effects of what they're doing, because they're not getting paid to look at the side effects of what they're doing. If we're trying to, let's say we're trying to eliminate or reduce bullying, which is happens in, like, it does make me laugh, because people will often say how awful STEM is because, you know, these mean people are bullying, you know, the males are bullying the females. And the reality is, for example, if you go look at the profession of nursing, bullying is so bad by nurse on nurse that it even has a name. It's nurses eat their young. So bullying actually doesn't just happen in the STEM disciplines, and it happens in every discipline.
Mm.
There was an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education in 1995 where a Harvard professor, Robert Coles, said, you know, this woman came in, she's a student here, and she cleans dormitory rooms to get her way through Harvard. She's incredible. But she was crying because she cleaned the room of this one student who she had taken courses in morality with. He was a superstar, pre-med, successful journalist student. And every time she would clean his room, he would crudely proposition her.
Hmm.
And she was crying and just saying, you know, this institution is such a phony, because they're graduating. I mean, we graduate people all over the world that they're great poets or great scientists or great politicians. And then they go off and they do horrific things. And they've taken the morality courses and they ace them. So we're not really teaching morality. So a lot of times I think that programs that companies can have to improve people interacting with one another and to mitigate bullying and so forth, they're not going to change the people who are sitting there going, yeah, I got this. I'm a really good person. And then they'll just turn right around and do whatever nefarious thing you don't want them to be doing. And then the people that the company is paying a lot of money to will say, you know, you just haven't trained enough, you know, and you're never going to reach these people. But, you know, the training companies are not going to admit that. They're just going to say, you're just not quite doing it right. You got to put a lot of more money into me or our company. So there's a lot of pathologies of altruism with companies, but I do think that companies can make a tremendous difference. They just have to look more critically at what's actually going on. Is that training company really making a difference? Or are they making a lot of money and just allowing the company to say, you know, I get a free pass because I'm paying a lot to these people to improve this situation. So clearly it must be effective.
Yeah.
You know, being willing to step back and say, is this actually the best place I could be using, you know, for my money? Should it be training within my company or should it be helping to rebuild a school? Mm. Just don't take for granted that just because a company is saying, yeah, we're fixing this problem, often they're only fixing that problem, but making other problems a lot worse, creating more divisiveness, for example, or misspending of money.
Well, it can be intimidating to even ask the question sometimes. And I'll use a specific example of something that we have invested in at P&G that the mere fact that I'm bringing this up is going to create some tension, I think, in the system. But in 2017 and subsequently, we invested in producing and promoting, call it a force for good advertisement. The first variation of it was called The Talk. And it highlights the painful but necessary conversations Black parents have with their children to help prepare them for prejudices they may face growing up in society that judges them based on the color of their skin. And very few people will debate the need for improvement in the area of equality and inclusion, particularly for people of color in the United States. Where I think it gets challenging is various discussion and debate about how to approach it. And this is one example of, I think, by merely asking the question of, by singling out a particular part of the population, is there potential for unintended consequences that actually make the problem worse? Whether that's true or not, I think even just having that conversation is met with resistance. What do you think about that?
Of course, it's met with resistance because there's lots of vested interests. However you slice this pie, there are going to be people who are going to be affected by it for good or for ill. There are really good research studies that have done massive reviews of work in this area and that show that many of the interventions proposed are actually ineffective. And it's incumbent on us to follow the science. Okay, if those programs are ineffective, what is effective? And don't just follow your intuition and your, you know, your gut feelings, your value function, but objectively, what does research say is actually going to be most helpful? Because what we really want is to reduce, insofar as possible, divisiveness, racial inequities. I mean, I think every reasonable human being is really on that page. But we just have to be careful that we don't buy into something that's like critical incident stress debriefing. It sounds really good and everybody's doing it, but it's actually making the situation worse.
Are you familiar with the science in this particular area of racial equality and what has been shown to work and not work?
Well, so far, there's very little that actually works. For example, you can find a program, you know, growing from University X, and then you look at what research has shown that this is effective. And they'll say, well, we've got a published study. Has it been replicated? Who else is doing it? Are the people who are replicating it Do they have a vested interest in also making it? There's so much evidence that if researchers believe something is true, they will set their studies up to make it be true, whether or not it actually is true. And that is what a lot of research evidence is showing, is that many of these programs, they haven't been replicated. Mm. When you really look at the statistics of the program, it's not effective. Should we really be spending lots and lots of money to do programs that, you know, may sound really great, but they actually may be making the situation worse? And in fact, there's evidence that some or perhaps even many of these programs are actually making the situation worse.
Right.
So, you know, I think we just have to be careful and keep in mind pathologies of altruism.
Yeah.
Are we putting these programs in place that sound really great, but they're actually just making things worse?
Mm.
You know, I volunteered for 5 years in an inner urban school district, and the kids were unbelievably talented. They were just awesome. The school, I mean, I saw kids who had not ever had a math problem homework corrected, you know, and they're like in ninth grade. Never, ever.
Wow.
Play that out at a mass scale of how many people go through an educational system. They come from disadvantaged backgrounds. You know, we want to put a little Band-Aid on at the top and say, well, we're going to just fix everything and make it all equal. Allow people to go into engineering at a top level university. And of course, they don't have the background. They don't have the training. But nobody wants to say, well, you know, we got to go into K-12 and we've got to fix the education system because there's too many vested interests there. You know, let's just say that there are those who are deeply entrenched in the current way of doing things, and they're okay with Band-Aids at the end.
Mm.
Because actually making a substantive change in the education that many of these disadvantaged children are receiving would upset a lot of apple carts, you know, people who are benefiting, groups who are benefiting from the status quo.
I don't know what to do with that as an individual, or even from the perspective of P&G, a large Fortune 50 company. Because you hear about something like what you just described at an urban inner city school, and you say, well, something has to be done. And if your two options are do nothing or do something that might make the situation better for at least some, but it could also make the situation worse, it's very hard to do nothing.
But at the same time, you know, we have to think about even businesses themselves. You'll often hear from very well-meaning people that capitalism and corporations are evil. They're psychopaths. They're stealing from society. The reality is they're ways of organizing people to get productive things done that help other people.
Right.
So if you look at what Procter & Gamble is doing, for example, it's doing a lot of good for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little frustrating for me sometimes to see companies doing great things that are really helping people, whereas what some in society will often say is, no, you have to go make nothing and work for a not-for-profit, you know, a non-governmental agency somewhere that actually may be doing something that's pathologically altruistic, and that's the only way that you can truly be helping people.
Hmm.
So I think one thing is, don't forget the good that you are already doing.
Mm-hmm.
So Procter & Gamble, they're already doing an enormous amount of good for people.
Mm-hmm.
And just look carefully at whatever you might be donating your time to or working to help others with. I'm not saying, you know, well, all altruism is pathological. It's just that you have to step back and look objectively at the wider side effects of whatever program you have, either within a company, outside a company, within your own personal life, or in the kinds of things you're doing to help others in your personal life. Try to get away from that sense of, you know, I feel it's good, it's got to be good, I know it's good, and finding a way to justify it because you know, you feel it, but actually looking objectively at what's happening.
Yeah, there's a healthy skepticism
right.
that I think we need as it relates to even acts or activities that on the surface seem objectively altruistic.
Exactly right.
Barbara, there's a concept that you and I discussed before we pressed record that I think is very interesting. I'd love to double click on it since I think it's so relevant given some of the things that are going on today culturally. Can you explain what the Abilene paradox is? And importantly, how the concept differs from groupthink, which is something that we do talk a lot about, and it's different than that.
I think most people have been in situations like this. My husband worked for a major automotive manufacturing firm, and they would have this phenomenon that they called getting on the train to Abilene. And metaphorically speaking, it's like going to a small town in the middle of nowhere. So if you're from Abilene, things are very different now, and so please forgive me. So the idea of getting on a train to Abilene is like getting all excited, getting on a train, and going actually absolutely nowhere. And this happens in business all the time. So what can happen is an executive, for example, will get it in mind that there is some approach that is like the best approach. And it doesn't matter what the research might objectively show about what this plan of action actually is. It's just that that executive has got in their procedural systems value function that this approach is the best approach, and they won't listen to anything else.
Right.
And then they get the whole company charging in this one direction.
Yeah.
Or that division of the company charging in this direction, which a lot of the people at the company go, you know, this is a dead end. It's a really wrong thing. But what can happen, especially if you have a very smart leader who is using their procedural gut feelings about things, and they will wall themselves off from any kind of contrary opinion. And really great leaders oftentimes will surround themselves with people who have contrary opinions, who have differing sorts of thoughts.
Right.
And they will read conflicting information. They will try to train their procedural system value function on a variety of information. But those who don't do that, they feel like they're doing that. You know, it's like, well, yeah, I've got sort of people who will tell me no, but not really. Most people would say, nah, you're surrounded with a bunch of yes men or yes women.
Right. Well, and I've seen it before that leaders will get a lot of pushback on tactics, but nothing related to strategy and sort of the foundational approach. And that's something to watch out for, I think.
Yes. And the hard thing is that sometimes a short-term tactic can look negative, but it helps hold together a long-term strategy that is a really good strategy. And so how do you know the difference? You know, it can be really tough. There can be very isolated and increasingly self-isolated leaders who can really lead a company down dark paths. You know, and remember, companies are just ways of organizing people to do productive things that other people want. For example, I know at one automotive company, they wouldn't look at the data coming back from surveys about what people wanted and what they didn't. One executive was like convinced that this one car, he just loved it, and it didn't matter if all the surveys were coming back and saying that this was not going to sell well in the U.S. He charged ahead, and it was a dramatic $100 million and more failure for the car company.
Well, it's a double-edged sword sometimes because you have visionary, innovative leaders like James Dyson, who was told all along that people didn't want vacuum cleaners where they could see the dust accumulate in the vacuum. And it turns out that is actually really what people love about the vacuum, in addition to how it maintains suction a lot better. And Steve Jobs as well is somebody who...
I was just thinking of Steve Jobs. He's like, people often don't really even know what they actually want.
Right.
You got to give it to them.
Right.
You know, so I think looking at people's track records, so Steve Jobs, really innovative guy. Dyson, really innovative guy. Someone who's come up through the company ranks and never really done anything that more than superficially can look like it's innovative, that one maybe you want to be questioning.
Right. Well, what I also found interesting about when I was reading more about this train to Abilene or the Abilene paradox is that even if you don't have a leader that has set a rigid mandate, you can sometimes have groups of people that end up all agreeing to do something that no one actually wants to do or thinks is the right thing to do.
Right.
Do you have any advice, I guess, for avoiding the circumstances that lead to environments like that?
Oh, you know, that is a really difficult question. You've got to have leaders who are really capable and willing to listen to others. Some of the, you know, lean manufacturing experts, they refused to speak to anyone unless the president of the company was actually going to be in attendance, because that way they knew that people were actually paying attention from on high.
Wow.
I really think that it's the president and the key leaders of the company that set an example for, are you listening? Are you flexible? Or are you inflexible and willing to charge? Can we change people's innate, you know, what kind of personality type they are? I think the best thing to do is just pick your leaders very, very carefully.
Certainly. Well, and I think one potential solution, at least that you can do as an individual, if you haven't yet made your way to president or CEO, is to try to become aware of how the brain works in the way that you've written about and described today. I've found that for things as inconsequential as my piano lessons, it's been super helpful. And in a way, I would describe it as you can outsmart your own brain sometimes.
Can.
And I've been inspired and really fascinated to hear more about what you've learned and taught over the course of your career. So thank you for writing about it. I guess final question for you today, since this podcast is all about embracing possibility and new perspectives, is there anything we haven't talked about or any stories that you have that maybe you want to leave the listeners with today under that umbrella theme?
Learn to grow comfortable with being uncomfortable, and don't accept something that just superficially sounds good. Making P&G a more effective, efficient, and happy place for people to be, or, you know, happy can also mean intimidating sometimes and motivating for people to aspire higher. You almost have to use deliberate practice. You know, you got to really focus in and not pick the easy solutions off the shelf. Oh, yeah, we'll hire this company that will, you know, magically fix people's thinking or something like that. But actually really, really thinking about things in a deliberate way, that can be really, really helpful for every company in the long term. And companies do such enormous good for society. Don't dismiss the great good that P&G is doing.
Love it. Well, I think that's a great way to conclude our conversation. Thank you again for taking the time, for sharing your insights, your stories, and for joining the More Than So podcast. It's been a pleasure having you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure for me too. Thanks so much.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Roman Segal.
And I'm still Andrew Tarvin. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.